Welcome to the Specialty Coffee Podcast by Storyline Coffee Roasters. Before we begin this episode today, just want to give a quick shout out to Range Leather. They hooked us up with some amazing hats. They also are going to be starting a specialty coffee roastery and shop in Wyoming. And so we are going to be doing a giveaway along with Range Leather here soon. So be sure to check out Storyline's Instagram and Range Leather's for the details on that giveaway. And if you're in the Wyoming area, be sure to check out their new place when it opens up. Anyways, I am super excited today for our guest. We have Trevor Corlett on. He is the CEO and founder of Madcap Coffee. He has an amazing pedigree, so much so that there's no way I'll remember all this. So I'm just going to read off of it. But Trevor, you started, obviously, you founded Madcap, and you are a specialized instructor for the SCA. You are a subject matter expert for Espresso. You also are an editorial advisor for Barista Magazine. You have been a contributor to Fresh Cup Magazine. You were named one of the most influential people in the beverage industry in 2013. You've been doing barista competitions since 2008. And you have such a wealth of knowledge in industry. So Trevor, I'm honored to have you on our show and dive into everything specialty coffee.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler. Thanks for having me on. I'm just excited to talk.
Right on. Yeah, it's going to be great. So let's just dive into, how did you start off into specialty and what made you want to be like, hey, let's start a business?
Oh, man. The short story, I got into coffee for a lot of the reasons why when I'm consulting, I tell people not to do it. I got into it not for the coffee, but for the atmosphere that coffee shops provide, the community aspect of it. And fell in love with that environment and wanted to create that and offer that to people in the places I found myself living in. So that's what first drew me into it. And then I think my personality being what it is, when I decide I'm going to do something, I go a little crazy digging into the rabbit hole of what's yeah. underneath. And then the more I learned about coffee, the more obsessed I became with coffee. So I think, yeah, while the ethos of the cafe culture has always been a motivating factor for me in working in coffee as long as I have, it shifted to the coffee holds as much weight in that and all the people that touch it as much as just the cafe environment does in terms of what motivates me. So,
yeah, that's awesome. So when did you first launch into and say, hey, I'm going to do this, I'm going to dive into it? When was that, and what business did you start right out the gate?
Yeah, so I wrote my first business plan for a coffee shop in 1999. Wow. To age myself. I had no experience in coffee whatsoever, and it was so hard to find information on coffee, how to run a coffee business and things at that time. Folks were a little more keeping things close to their chest as it related to how to roast coffee, how to run a coffee shop, things of that nature. So that started me down the path of trying to find work in coffee that would give me the experience I needed to sort of support that business plan that I had pulled out of thin air. I had a lot of retail management experience. And so utilizing that, I kind of found a startup that allowed me to help them open and run a cafe and music venue in Indianapolis. So that was my first job in coffee. Oh, cool. I was only there about a year and a half because I really wanted to do my own thing. And every step of the way, I think slowly, like as I mentioned, the more I dug underneath the surface of it and got exposed to different parts of the industry, the more interested I became in trying to do it and just being stubborn, had to do it my way, I guess you could say. So I grew up south of Chicago, about 45 minutes south of Chicago. And so I left my job at Indy to actually move back in to my parents' basement and bought a tabletop electric roaster and wow. started teaching myself how to roast coffee while I worked part-time at a water softener company for like $6.75 an hour. Cause jeez. I was like, man, I gotta learn about water. So I can learn. And I really didn't learn anything about water there. I delivered a lot of salt and installed water softeners. So,
yeah.
But it was side hustle, right? And so, I started down the rabbit hole that way. And like, to be completely transparent with you, like when I got started, I was doing, you know, I was buying spot coffee off of somebody's list, trying to figure it out, selling to friends. I did some flavored coffee. So I was flavoring some coffee beans with some really gross chemical stuff at the time. And,
yeah.
You know, it was probably my best selling product too. If I still could remember and had the data for it, I'm sure. But yeah, I did that for a little over a year, just out of a really cheap, low budget, tiny office space and did that thing. And then, I ended up finding a property where I ran a drive through cafe and roastery. That only lasted about a year. It was an old used car lot, and I put a little one group espresso machine in there and took my tabletop roaster and was trying to hustle that way. Met someone who was I had a customer who was a president of a university at the time, who's like, "Hey, we've got a building. We'd love to have somebody put a coffee shop in it." And so, so my next step from there was, I put a cafe and roastery into this, spot that the university hooked me up with that was across from their campus. Spent 3.5 years doing that. And so that was probably my biggest learning curve, or not learning curve isn't the right word, but my biggest educational time span as it relates to coffee, because, it was pretty successful out of the gate. I had a built in customer base with, you know, the college being right there, in the part of Illinois I was in. And, it kind of looked like every other like 90s bohemian coffee shop at the time, right? In the early 2000s. And so it's like comfortable seating, 2 floors of seating. I had a huge patio. I was doing live music on the weekends. Like we had 30 flavored syrups, you know, and,
typical.
It was very much like the cliche coffee shop, Central Perk kind of vibes. And, but again, like the more I learned about coffee, the more obsessed I became with it. And then the more I discovered about what was happening on the producing side of it, I became really passionate about producers and trying to, pay fair prices for coffee. And so I'd gotten fair trade certified, at one point, and so was selling all fair trade certified coffee, and then sort of became really, I think that process really informed a lot of the decisions I made with Madcap, because, the lack of, fair trade for me was a stepping stone. Like there were some good things happening, but ultimately it wasn't based on quality. You weren't exactly sure how much money was actually going directly to the producer, how much was going to their community to be dictating how it was used and things like that. So that piece especially really motivated how, as Madcap, we decided we were going to buy coffee. I did start competing, with that business for the first time. And my first exposure to competitions was in 2006. So it would have been the second year, I think, the U.S. Barista Championships had been a thing. And Intelligentsia was hosting the competition, but it was at Kendall College in Chicago. There was maybe like 25 people in the audience, and they were giving out free t-shirts to everyone who attended, which I think most of them were people working for those companies or family, I was just blown away by the whole experience. I'm like, what the heck is this thing? And just really, I think being far enough removed from the city of Chicago that like, I didn't feel like, I had access to what really good coffee looked like in these other places, and really saw competitions as an opportunity for myself to see how was what I was doing comparing to what all these larger companies were doing. The first year I competed was 2008. And it was entertaining. I did it. I did the thing.
Yeah. What was competitions like in 2008? Because those are the early years of competitions, which I have heard from people looks incredibly different than it does today.
So different. Well,
yeah, like give me just so a quick different. Rundown on what it was like.
Yeah, man. Traditional espresso blends were still the thing, you know. So if I remember correctly, I had roasted like an espresso blend that was like Ethiopia Harar Natural and a semi-wash Brazil, and then like 10% of it was like Indian Monsoon Malabar or something like that instead of a Robusta. And it was weird. Like you couldn't, if you visualize what competitions look like now, like you couldn't set your table and everything until your time started. So your judges were sitting at just an empty table. And so you start your time and you're trying to set up all your station and everything as quickly as humanly possible. Doserless grinders were just new in the market. Cause I think James Hoffman won the WBC in 2007 with the Malkonig K30. Kind of the first time people had really seen the doserless grinders. And I had gotten my hands on one to use because I'm like, well, this dude won last year with this thing. I got to use it, and totally was using it incorrectly and just had coffee everywhere.
Sure.
And then also the big thing back then too was to hide everything. Like once you were done using things, you would hide them under your station, like in bus tubs or just on the ground. So you would use different elements and components, and then you just put everything under your table, so that by the end there was like nothing on your stations. It was a very different time. It was a very different time. Signature drinks tended to be really big back then, and now most signature drinks are like 3 to 4 ounces in cordial glasses,
totally
very, very, very different. There's a lot more people, dressing up in costumes or very, very, very formal. I rocked a lot of ties. I think even the last year I competed, I always kind of kept the tie in fair play. They looked very different. It's interesting having, doing it for 10 years and being a part of it changing so much, and then having people still a part of it that, I'm trying to help and support and encourage to do it. As a cafe owner, and a roaster, seeing how consumers' palates change over time. It's not just our consumers, right? Like we as industry professionals, our palates have changed over time. So watching how the judges are looking for different things and everything, it's super fascinating. And it's a very interesting lens to look at the industry through, and not a perfect representation, or maybe even that close of a representation of what's actually happening, in cafe environments, but cool nonetheless, I think. Right.
Yeah. A good glimpse into kind of new and innovative things, I think, is kind of what, expos and competitions have kind of become. It's like, let's just get a window into what may be possible or what's new and up and coming. And it's cool to hear from someone who's had, from 06, 08 till now, just the being able to see the landscape change. What's some of those trends that you've kind of seen, and where do you think things are kind of headed towards now as we look forward?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm not super stoked about the trends that are happening in competition right now, mainly because it's really you don't see things being rewarded that are things that are necessarily going to be taken back into cafes. That's obviously a very personal opinion. I think my approach, was always unique because I was both, a barista, roaster, owner. And so my motivations in competition were always driven by a lot of different things. I think some of the things that excited me, that hooked me on competition initially, was one, just being a competitive person. And so I liked that aspect of it. But also there was a point early on, even that first couple of years I was competing, where I realized that preparing for this game was making me better in my day-to-day time being spent behind the bar. So I was working more efficiently. I was working cleaner. The way I talked about the coffee to customers was changing. And so I saw it influencing me. And as a business owner, it was like, oh, hey, there's something here that's valuable. And so, you know, it's that part where it's like, you know, Madcap, if you watch any of my folks compete, there's definitely, I definitely pressure slash encourage them, like, hey, if you're doing this, this is something I want, like, we should be able to say, we offer this coffee in our cafes. You can go get it right now. Like, we will serve this drink in our cafes. You can go get it right now. And so, I mean, Madcap, if you look at our seasonal drink menu right now and the way that it looks and things, like, this is a thing that was inspired by competition and 10 years of making signature drinks that just disappeared after serving them to like 12 people, and realizing how silly it was. And like, competition drinks don't inherently translate back right into the cafe seamlessly, but with a little manipulation, we can, you know, put it on a menu and make it attractive to most of our guests. And so that's, you know, something that's become a part of our DNA and who we are and how we build out our menu. So there's been so much value add equipment, how equipment's used, workflow, like all these things. Like, there's been amazing takeaways from competition over the years, and even with changes and things like that, that I've definitely stolen or had influenced me in how we work and how we run our cafes, for sure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it really forces you to be super concise, not only with the language you're using to convey what beverage you're making and why you selected that coffee, but also, you know, there's no wasted movement or time, and that translates directly back to bar. I agree with you in the sense that sometimes, you know, competitions get so crazy that it's like, is that replicatable? Like, you know, the drink that you're making looks amazing and it looks awesome. But I love that you guys bring that back to like, hey, you can order this, like, come to our shop at Madcap and like grab this drink. And that is cool because it actually translates to a consumer and they're like, oh, this is the same drink, you know, or like a close spin off of it, right? Mm-hmm. That was used in competition. Like, this is actually what they were talking about. This is the coffee they sourced and why they chose this, you know, whatever elements that they chose to select and the milks and all that kind of stuff that goes into it. And it actually can then relate back to your consumer base as opposed to just this, like, you know, watching a competition's like, oh, that's cool, I'm sure it tastes great. And it just kind of ends there, right? Like,
yeah.
So it's cool that you guys bring that back. How has it been kind of mentoring and from someone who's competed to now kind of someone who's coaching and mentoring? What does that kind of look like for you guys at Madcap?
Yeah, it's hard, and I don't think I'm very good at it. and I think why it's hard is because from my approach too, I take a similar approach to what I had and how I competed, which was like, I really want, like, when I have people compete, I really, really want it to be an expression of themselves and not me dictating what coffee they should use, what drink they should make, what they should be saying, and all those things, right? And so I think, you know, it's pretty easy to watch. And I don't know enough to know if this still happens, and I'd be shocked if it doesn't. But, you know, a lot of big companies that were very successful in competing over the years, I mean, there wasn't a lot of, you know, there were a lot of competitors that didn't necessarily have a lot of control over what it was they were providing or serving or the story they were telling and things like that. And I think intrinsically with the way the coffee culture has shifted and the things that have changed, that I think, you know, the competition stage has become more a platform for people to express their voices more than anything.
Yeah.
But I do know, as someone who is always determined to do things their own way, and not necessarily what I thought or was pretty confident that I knew what the judges wanted, and I didn't want to do it that way anyway. So, essentially received feedback in that similar vein of multiple times over the years. But I think in that sense, right, you walk this line of like, you know, constantly, I mean, you know, the people that are successful more often than not aren't one-offs necessarily, right?
Yeah.
Like, they've done their research. They've, you know, I mean, Isaiah, who just won, I mean, he's an OG for the most part, in terms of like folks competing nowadays. You know, I think he started shortly after I did. He took a couple of years off to judge, which you see a lot of people do, to try and gain insight into, like, you know, what is it exactly the judges are looking for and how could I do a better job of providing that for them, and things like that. So, you know, coming into it as, you know, I think our approach as a company, I think because of, definitely because of my influence and where I see it adding value for people on an individual level is like, you know, we have certain expectations just because of who we are. And, you know, we should be able to set you up for a certain level of success, whatever you define that success being. And maybe it's just qualifying. Maybe it's, you know, finishing in the top 10 of a qualifier, you know, maybe it's making semifinals at USBC, whatever that is. And I can do my best to tell you what it is I think it'll take for you to get there. But at the same time, it's almost more valuable for them to sort of express themselves through that channel of competition, right? And so, and seeing the professional development. I mean, the barista that we had competing this year, he's only been with us 2 years. He competed in the Brewers Cup last year, did amazing, finished ninth in the U.S. at the Brewers, U.S. Brewers Cup last year. Wow. Using a coffee from Kenya that we tried our best to talk him out of using it because yeah. we're like, you're based on the other coffees that do really well in Brewers Cup, you're gonna have a really hard time with this washed Kenya. And he was determined because it fit the story he really wanted to convey and what moved him and was passionate, you know, what I think, yeah, most inspired him about it and tied it into his own personal story. And he did amazing. Like, he, you know, finishing in the place he did, with the coffee he had, as little experience as he had working in coffee at that point, was just a testament to his drive and passion and everything else. Yeah. And so I think similar vein this year, he wanted to, you know, he wanted to do the barista. And, we have developed a system in which people, you know, can go through and get support and practice and qualify for it. And they have to make a certain level of commitment if we're, as a company, going to support folks in doing that. And the dude put in a lot of serious time. And I think that gets to be the hardest part, like with where I am at, both professionally and personally in my life, like, hanging out with a barista until like 11, 12 o'clock at night, man, is not in the cards very much anymore. Right, so, yeah. And so then it's just really relying on a lot of the team members to be able to support those folks and everything else. But yeah, seeing people go through that process and the heartbreak and, you know, watching them get up there and wait to see if their name's called. And it's like, man, I did that for 10 years. Like, yeah. I don't miss that part of it at all. But it's so cool. I mean, selfishly, very rewarding for me to see people go through that process, to see how it influences them in their work environment when they come back, and whether they're working in the cafe or whatever capacity they're working for us. It's so cool to see. And so I think, you know, we've always sort of leveraged it as like, you know, we don't have any expectations that people are going to go out there and win the USBC. You know, that would be an amazing thing, but there's so much more value to be had through the process, both in professional development, but also in the relationships with your coworkers, with producers, and like having phone conversations with the producer that they're of whose coffee they're working with, and all of those pieces. You know, so that there's so much value to be gained in that capacity. And so it makes competition a lot more than what it seems on the surface, I guess.
Yeah, no, totally. I think it just gives you so much. you know, I love that, you know, in the Brewers Cup, he held fast, like, no, like, this is what I'm passionate about. This is the coffee I want, because it speaks to the fact, you know, kind of like we mentioned earlier, there's a fine line between, like, hey, we're going to just do everything we possibly can to have you win, and hey, we're going to do everything we can to set you up for success. And if that means you're passionate about this coffee and the story behind it, and you connect with the producer, then great. Like, that's success for you. Let's go for it. And I think that's more empowering and more, that moves me more than it does, like, hey, you need to pick this coffee and brew, you know, like, we can manipulate you into this system that you may have a better chance of success. But at the end of the day, like, you know, all those hours that you spend brewing, like, you have to have that level of passion and desire and drive to get you to want to compete, and then bring that back and feel like, man, I gave it everything I had. And I think that's, like you were saying, so much more valuable than what it could be if you're just like, hey, we've sourced these three coffees, pick which one you think's gonna be best. This one really is best. You know, like, that's, you know, kind of just takes a lot of the fun out of it. So,
yeah. And to be honest too, like, I don't even know if I could, you know, I might be able to get one of my folks to third place in the U.S. because that's as high as I ever got multiple times. Right. So I don't know what first or second looks like, but I'm very intimate with third and fourth place. So.
you've lived in that third. You finished third, what, two or three times, right?
Yeah, at least twice. My memory's horrible. I finished in the top six, I think, four times.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe five, because I don't think I got six, but I know I got a fifth place. And then I finished in like seventh and eighth a few times. I made a name for myself for going over time. Like, not just once or twice, like consistently.
And
there was a year in between. I think I had back-to-back third place finishes, and then in the semifinals I served my last drink with like 40 seconds to go still in my presentation, and I was like, oh wow, this was like the fastest I finished, this is great.
Yeah.
And so, like, I went around and cleaned up stuff while the judges were enjoying the last drink, and then I went back and started talking, and I didn't stop. And when I called time, I had gone like 40 seconds over. And I looked and I turned, and my team was like lying on the ground. Like,
just like, no,
what the heck did he just do? Yeah. And I can remember they had voiceover commentary at the time with the competitions for all the rounds of the USBC. And Peter Giuliano was commentating during my performance. And at one point in this long rambling that I was doing over time, he says, I just love how confident he is, and he is determined to say what he has to say. And I can remember watching it after the fact and thinking, no, Peter, like, someone needs to tell me to shut up. Like, what's happening?
I should have just stopped. Yeah.
Yeah. And the most heartbreaking part was I missed finals by a point and a half. So I gave away 40 points and had missed finals by a point and a half. And my team gave me such a heart. But that was like me consistently year over year. And it wasn't until when they changed the structure to like the 10-minute qualifiers, just two courses and stuff like that, which was the very last year I competed. Although they did try live scoring. So they did, it wasn't qualifiers then. They had an Eastern Conference Championship and a Western Conference Championship. And so it's like everyone, you know, in the East Coast / Midwest, East Coast, whatever the dividing line was, did this competition. And it was the 10-minute qualifier structure, but they did live scoring. So it was like every five people that went, they would start posting people's scores. And so I can remember competing, doing my presentation, and then seeing that I had the first place spot. And then I realized that Lem Butler still had to compete, and Sam Lewontin still had to compete. I'm like, I'm not gonna win this one. And then I think I was out grabbing a drink when they posted their live scores, and I think it was Sam Lewontin who actually had texted. He's at Stumptown now. He used to be at Everyman, but he texted me and said, "Hey, congratulations!" I'm like, what? He's like, "Yeah, you won." And so that felt really great until USBC Finals when Lem decided to. to bring it home, and I got fifth on that one. That was the year I said, all right, I've had enough. I've done this long enough.
You've had a long run.
I can be done. Yeah,
for sure, man. So jumping back to the business side of things, you had run a drive-through. You did that for a short period of time and then went into a kind of campus coffee shop, did that for a couple of years. What was kind of the turning point for you of like, okay, I want to start something new. I've learned these lessons kind of from, you know, I feel like in the specialty world, I don't know if you'd consider yourself specialty back in, you know, 99 and 2000, but like, being a roaster in those early years, what did you kind of take from that to be like, okay, let's do Madcap. Let's start this thing.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you for sure the tipping point for me. And I don't know. You asked an interesting question. I think specialty wasn't even a word in my radar necessarily back then. And I mean, we still, right, as an industry, have a hard time defining it now, ironically. But yeah, I think the tipping point for me was in that campus shop I had. It was like about 2 years in where all of a sudden I just, you know, I'd call it an epiphany maybe or something, but I just woke up and I'm like looking at what I had created. And this is obviously a reflection on myself and the high standards I put to myself. But thinking like, I'm not super proud of this, like this. Yeah. This isn't that, I haven't created anything that special. And obviously I was looking at it from the product sort of coffee perspective, as opposed, sure, to, you know, I had a space that was, you know, the thing that I told you initially drew me into it. Like I had that, like I had this community space. You know, we had, just some cool vibes with the live music we were bringing in and open mics and fun stuff like that. And, you know, people hanging out. And because it was close to a college, like I had crazy stupid hours, you know, being open till midnight and stuff like that.
Right.
And it definitely like served, it was serving a purpose and definitely, you know, definitely when I left, the sentiment of like, you know, how much it was missed by people and things like that was, you know, expressed to me, which was hard, but yeah, I just kind of woke up and looked at what I was doing. I was like, I don't feel great about this. And I think I learned enough about the sourcing side and what was happening there that I had this epiphany. Yeah. That like, man, coffee being the global thing that it is, like even a single coffee shop can have a global positive impact by how it decides, like how it decides to spend its money on coffee and everything else. And so, that was definitely kind of the turning point for me, on, you know, I need to create something else that looks different and prioritizes things differently. And so I think, you know, obviously, you know, the thing that caused that shop to go out of business wasn't the fact that we didn't have any business. You know, that shop had become profitable within the first year. But it had more to do with the investor partner that I had in that space. When I started making changes towards quality and started cutting out syrups and like paying more for coffee and doing those kinds of things, it's created a huge rift with the person that I was invested with. And you know, being naive and not understanding what a partnership would look like or legally what things I should have in place to protect myself and the business. Sure. At the end of the day, I walked away from that business because I was, again, it was so important to me that I have a business with my name on it that I was proud of and felt was making a positive difference, that I just couldn't tolerate doing that day in and day out. So you know, and again, that had more to do with my personal convictions than anything else, right? And so that informed so much of what Madcap was grounded on, in the sense of like it was such a 180 degree turn from what I had been doing. You know, like when I started Madcap, part of it too was definitely having some of my baristas that followed me out here to help me start it. And they were, you know, they did that because they were as committed to those things as I was, you know? And so making the decision to only have a, you know, three syrups on our menu. Well, one was technically off menu, but, just, you know, going so hard, like only one drink size and like all these crazy things. And, you know, when we opened in 2008, we were doing everything. All our filtered coffee was brewed in like 48 ounce, Bodum double walled, French presses that we poured into pump pots through tea filters, which I think, I had taken from Stumptown, because I think that's how Stumptown was doing their coffee. This was before pourovers, right? And so, so that's how we were doing our filtered coffee initially. And then in like June or July of 2009, through competition, I had a pretty good relationship with a lot of people at Intelligentsia, just because there was a nice camaraderie there amongst competitors. And I had actually talked to Doug Zell, the founder and CEO at Intelligentsia at the time, and he had sort of given me a hard time because Intelligentsia had just moved to buy the cup pour overs and was asking me why I wasn't doing that instead of these French press things. And I was like, oh man, like I can't make, you know, can't make people wait that long and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, if I can do it in downtown Chicago, man, you can do it in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hmm. And so being a competitive person again, I'm like, you know what, man, I can do that.
I can.
Like, yeah. And so, yeah. So the summer of 09, we had switched to, you know, B60s, I think at that time.
Wow.
By the cup and, you know, old pictures, we had a rack of like eight V60s and like just, we did so much training on like the double pour over, man. And just like how many cups of coffee
you can
brew at the same time, with the same, you know, circular motion and, you know, we were using a paddle for agitation at that time and all these crazy things that we were doing.
Wow.
And he wasn't wrong at that time. I mean, I was barely, I mean, the cafe was so slow when we first started. I think it took me 4 years to start even turning a profit because just the time frame and being in Michigan and downtown Grand Rapids was definitely a ghost town at that time. And so, I mean, I consider myself privileged to have started in a downtown area that was kind of dying and got to be part of a resurgence that happened. And you know, now we just have a booming downtown area in Grand Rapids and it's really awesome, how much it's changed. And so, you know, so going back to even how coffee shops and companies fill this communal aspect of a community and space, like it's pretty cool to be a part of stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. What, like, how did you make it through those first 4 years? What were some lessons that you drew from on the business side of things that were like, man, this is what kept us going? And did you have a pretty good customer base or following that you had developed there? And what was kind of those lessons in those early years of starting Madcap and being a front runner and kind of front pusher for specialty, I'm sure, in that space in that time for sure.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I mean, I was just super naive, man, going into it,
sure.
Which I think, like, there's its positives to just, like, being so committed to a thing, and you know, for the right reasons, I would like to think, played a big aspect of it, and I think, you know, definitely from the perspective of having a super solid business plan, of having an appropriate amount of financing, of, you know, having fair expectations of the people that were working alongside me, like those things definitely weren't there. I mean, by the time I got through my other two initial attempts at a coffee business and started Madcap, like I had ruined my credit by that point. Like nobody was going to give me any money, man, to start a business. And so, ironically, my parents at that point had sort of implied like, hey, we think you've learned a lot and kind of, you know what you're doing at this point. And so we're going to help you out. So like my parents mortgaged their house to loan me the money to start Madcap. And so talk about a motivating factor when your parents' house is on the line. Not that they couldn't have figured it out without me, probably, but you know, that's not, I mean, it's very common, right, for folks to use family support to finance businesses and things like that. But it definitely makes it that much harder. And so I think, you know, learning a lot about organizational infrastructure and like, and not being prepared for growth. And like, we made a commitment to buying coffee the way we were buying coffee, which everyone told me when I first started, like, you're not going to be able to source direct as a small startup like this. It's not going to be sustainable, right? Which just made me determined to do it that much more, for good or bad. And I think, you know, in order to buy, the cafe being so slow as it was, I had no intention of doing wholesale initially. And our wholesale business grew out of the fact that I had to do more volume and couldn't, you know, the idea of opening another cafe was not in the cards. And so it's like, well, we got to do wholesale. And so, you know, for whether it's a right reason or not, like, competition for us served as a way that we got our name out there. Cause I wasn't spending any money on marketing, that's for sure. And so our wholesale business grew out of our involvement in competition. And, you know, there was a point where we were selling more coffee in the West Coast than we were in our own state. And that's just the trends of coffee, and the state of Michigan wasn't quite there yet in terms of specialty and what people were doing. And so, you know, it's just, I think from that perspective, like, you know, and then wholesale is super hard to do, and people, every customer has different expectations in terms of, you know, not just cost, and what they need for margins, or they don't know what they need for margins, which is more common than not. 100%. but training and all that support that goes into that, and the expectations, and, you know, coming out of a time when, like, you know, roasters in the early 2000s and late 90s were like giving away equipment, and that's how they got their customers, you know. And as a startup, like, I ain't giving nobody equipment, like, you need. And then when we would try to make situations like that work, you got people who, it's not their equipment, so they don't care about it. And so you're dealing with maintenance calls all the time because, you know, people are just treating their machines like trash. And so wholesale was just kind of the necessary evil from my perspective, and sort of still is. Like, it's really hard for me to, you know, selling my coffee to other folks and giving them the support that they often need with a lean team that can do justice to it. Right. It's just super hard, but yeah, it was necessary for us in terms of hitting the volume that we needed to make it sustainable to buy directly from producers and pay them fair prices for their coffee. And so, you know, I think that was a big learning curve. And I think just those commitments to, like, you know, when we committed to doing Pulver, the biggest thing was a staffing impact, right? Because suddenly you're committing to, you know, you've got to have someone manning this brew bar, where you could navigate not having to do that before. And so, whether you're busy enough or not, you were trying to, you know, and especially depending on what your quality standards are, and ours have always been very intense. And so, just being committed to that execution and that level of service and training, and, like, even knowing that, like, we still don't get it perfect, right? And I think, you know, hospitality and our perception of it has changed over time, and we weren't good at it before. I think because we took so personally how we were doing coffee, that how people enjoyed it was really important to us. And so, you know, not giving people cream or not putting their espresso over ice and all those dumb things.
Sure.
Like, that was us when we started. And so now learning that we have the knowledge and abilities, and we've trained our people well enough that they can accommodate the craziest of requests and give people an amazing experience. The goal being that you want people to keep coming back so that you can earn their trust and bring them into the story of why you do this with a certain coffee, and, you know, why we make it this way and why we enjoy it this way, which eventually won't unfold and reveal all the work that other people are putting into it that we're supporting, right? And so I think you kind of wrap up the idea of there needs to be a balance between the commitment you have to what motivates you in specialty coffee and how to run a business really well to support those things. And it hasn't gotten any easier, and I haven't found the answers yet. So if you know,
right. Yeah, it's when it's not easy. And I think, you know, I want to ask a bunch of questions, but it, in my head, it's so difficult because it's so specific, right? Like for a certain company, like wholesale may be huge and a big part of what they do and how they operate and why they do it. And for you guys, that may be something like, man, we do wholesale, but it's taxing, it's difficult on us. And like, it's hard to give someone like a cookie cutter idea of like, hey, here's, if you're starting a new roastery and coffee shop, like here's what I would do and how I would do it, because it's so dependent on like market and availability and competition. And there's just so much that goes into like running and operating a business well. But if you were to give someone advice, that's, I know you do consulting and things, what would kind of be your overall, like, hey, when starting out, these are the things that I would look at and what I've learned from over, you know, the years of doing this.
Yeah, man. I think, I mean, the biggest thing for me and the question I always ask people is like, what's going to make you stand out from anybody else? Mm. Like what, you know, why are you doing this? Because I think a lot of times, you know, as you probably know, a lot of folks that get into coffee or opening a coffee shop or transitioning from another industry, and they're like, you know, they were in legal and they're burned out, or they're in finance and they're burned out, and they love hanging out in these, you know, in a specialty shop and meeting with friends over coffee. And, so they have this really romantic sort of idea of what a coffee shop looks like. And then there's the reality of running a coffee shop. You know, and all the things that go into how are you going to execute drinks at a certain quality the same way every time? How are you going to train those people to do that? Like, how are you going to manage those people? How are you going to make sure that you're taking care of those people that work for you so that this very taxing, monotonous service job is rewarding for them and they feel supported? And, you know, there's so much impact and so many challenges in so many different areas. And much of that is like nobody talks about that to people a lot of times when they're opening a business, right? It's like when people reach out to us and they want to talk about prices. They want to talk about, you know, can you sell us equipment? What kind of support are you going to give us? And, you know, it's like, well, do you have a business plan? Can I see it? Like, do you, right. You know, how do you plan to, like, are you going to pay your people for training? Like, how much training are you going to give your people? And like, I think like those are the things, there are so many things that people, they look at recommendations I would make to them and they look at it on paper and they're like, I don't understand. That doesn't make any sense. Right. And you think about how little training and professional development most places give baristas.
Oh yeah.
And then you think about it from the perspective of where's the first role we always put baristas in? We've always put them at the register, right? So now your newest person,
is getting asked the most questions.
Yeah, they get asked the most questions. They're the first point of contact with a customer. Like how much training have they had? A couple hours? Like what have you done with them, right? And so obviously my background in doing coffee education is really influenced. And I think me accepting the fact that like, man, we were doing hospitality really bad. Like this isn't the goal. Right. And so how can we do it better? And so in essence, like hospitality should be as important as the espresso barista, who's got to learn how to dial in and pour a good latte art and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And so those things, one doesn't necessarily outweigh the other. They're all equally valuable. And so, but yeah, expressing that to folks when they're opening a shop for the first time, you know, and sometimes, and I'm still shocked. Like we might have been in conversations with someone for, you know, 8 or 9 months as they're planning, And then out of nowhere, I would get like, you know, questions where it's like, whoa, wait a minute, you should have this figured out already. Like, yeah. You're a month away from opening, you know?
Totally.
And so, like, I can understand it from a certain perspective. But I think also, you know, the surgence of how, like, I can understand why technology and, like, machines like the Eversys that have elevated the sort of super automatic experience, providing even more consistency in things at nearly a level that a well-trained barista can provide, is because there's still a misconception it's not easy to consistently provide great quality drinks. And people take it for granted so much. And even, you know, with tons of training and everything else, like, we don't always get it perfect. And having the training of like, well, shoot, that shot didn't pull the way I really wanted it to, or I didn't really seam that milk the way I wanted it to. Like, at that moment, when you realize that, what are you going to do with that? Like, yep. You still going to serve it? You going to dump it out? Like, what are you going to do? Right. And like, those are things, you know, like the amount of training and education that needs to go into giving a barista the empowerment and ability to critically think through those types of situations are the things that make or break, you know, a 5-star Google review or something like that. And sometimes you can't do anything good enough to get a 5-star sometimes, but,
yeah, no kidding.
But yeah, so it's so complex and so hard, but I also think, you know, the growth of specialty has also helped move that barometer more and more over the years. Like, you know, I can remember like doing road trips and like, you could never find a great cup of coffee and your road trip kit was more important than anything else almost. Right. And so it's gotten so much easier, man, to find a decent cup of coffee. I think that's just a testament to, you know, as many things that can still improve, there has been a lot of growth and improvement in the industry in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a testament to how far the industry's come, in that, you know, I think we're pushing to become more welcome and inviting and open. And, you know, like you said, to be willing to meet any of the crazy customer needs so that they have a good experience, and that over time you develop that relationship and trust so that they begin to understand, like, oh, this is why that matters. Like, this is why he never wanted me to put my espresso over ice. Like, I get it now, you know, like, but you've built that trust and that relationship with them to where they've wanted to come back, and they're not just put off by your barista's response of like, no, we're not doing that, you know? And so I think specialties come a long way in that sense, but.
Well, and I think it's even pushed us, right? Like, I think about, like, even using espresso over ice as an example, like, those sorts of things have also pushed us to find a way to execute those things and make them delicious. Right. And so it's like, you know, maybe it ends up looking like, you know, adding like half an ounce of like room temperature filtered water to that espresso and then adding it to ice and shaking it and then straining it out so there's less dilution. And that's what you're serving them. And all of a sudden you've served them something completely unexpected. And they're like, we just wanted espresso over ice. And then you're like, well, that's actually pretty good. And so it's forced us to accept, like, maybe I just need to try harder to make something taste good when I know that what the customer wants is just a chilled espresso. And there are ways to avoid the things that make that not amazing. Right. So, so I think, you know, but it took some growing up on my part for sure to realize, like, maybe I should just find a way to do this and make it good. And having people on my team who are also committed to doing that or telling me I needed to chill out. And
sure. Right. That's awesome. Well, what are some new things for Madcap that you guys have going on? What are you guys excited about for the future and kind of business development for you guys?
Oh man.
I know that's a big question.
That's a big question. Yeah, I mean, you know, post COVID, we're, you know, I just, you know, so going into COVID, right, we had four cafes going into COVID, And then we had one that was in like a market concept with lots of other businesses, like a really open market. Obviously that concepts like that struggled a lot during COVID, and we chose to close that one permanently during COVID. And then last summer, we had a wholesale account up in Northern Michigan that the owner retired, and we ended up buying that business off of them and flipping it to a Madcap location. It's in an area affectionately called Fishtown. It's in Leland, Michigan, but it's a bunch of fish shanties. It's on the lake. And so there's a big boating community and stuff there. But all these old fish shanties have been turned into businesses, art galleries and like sandwich shops and cool stuff. So
that's awesome.
It's a very unique environment. So we're back to four locations. We launched a new website during COVID because we saw a huge increase in online business during COVID, like a lot of people with any kind of online presence did. And we weren't ready for it. We didn't have a website that was built to sustain it. And so we launched a new website in the last couple of years. And now, you know, I went from like really investing little to nothing in a website because I wasn't super interested in doing that to, you know, now we have a full-time e-commerce person. And we're trying to build a lot of strategies for what it looks like to have a more progressive and interesting online presence. And I think there's part of the realization too that, like, you know, as a company who prioritizes and loves having direct interactions and creating elevated experiences with our guests in a retail environment, that online is just an extension of that digitally. And that, you know, we could really, just another unique way that is obviously in society now really important to people, but creating an online digital presence and finding great ways to elevate that experience for people. So, you know, we're really trying to explore that and figure out what that looks like. And, you know, having a team that's like trying to navigate, like, what does it look like for a coffee company to have a TikTok channel? So we've got one of those now. We've been pouring a lot, you know, so as I've alluded to through a lot of our conversation, like, education is really important to us. Like, we have a learning and development manager that's, his background was in elementary education. And so he's got an education background before he started working for us as a barista and then moved into his role for us now. And so, you know, we obviously, I mean, we prioritize training a lot. It's really important to us. And so we have a really robust internal education program for staff. And a lot of that through COVID, we moved online because we couldn't do as much in person. And then realized that I think especially because where our headquarters is and where two of our cafes are, our Detroit cafe is like just over 2 hours from us. And then the Northern Michigan spot that we opened is like 3.5 hours from us. So we're kind of pretty spread out, which makes training super hard. Means you're on the road a lot. And so, and then just recognizing like, hey, there's a lot of this education that we provide folks. It doesn't have to be in person. That doesn't have to be practical in nature, where you have to be there. And so, we've started using an online education platform where we've been building all this education through videos, and like online content and stuff for our staff. And so like when we drop a new coffee, like we put out videos rather than having like cut sheets where our team would read about the coffee, we now provide videos that are a resource where they watch them and they learn all about the new coffee we just released. Give them the top points we want to make sure that resonate with them and with guests. And so we've started finding these really unique ways to sort of share that information. And then we started taking that and really like, hey, we should do educational videos. Like, it's been a long time since someone's done a Chemex tutorial, right? So, so we've started doing educational content that we've been putting on YouTube. And we've done, you know, Chemex, we've done Kalita, we've done home espresso machines. We did a French press, and we're actually like We invite people to come in, and rather than just one person talking to you, we're actually teaching someone how to use it on film, to just give it a different approach and perspective, right? And some more realism to it, I guess. So that's become a huge aspect of where we're pouring a lot of time and effort and stuff in, just creating more resources. And, you know, it's been good, and it's a lot of fun. It's a good outlet for us, I think, to like pour ourselves into, and it's like things that we're already doing. And so finding ways to share that with the world, I guess, has become important for us. And again, it's not like, you know, it's content that's like, this might not be new to you. Like Chemex isn't new, but if you were curious how Madcap likes to brew a Chemex, this is how we do it. Right. And so, yeah. And I think, you know, just, we're constant. I mean, you know, I get bored really easily. So, you know, that has like ripple effects into the team in terms of, we're just always looking for ways to improve things. We're always looking for ways to improve the cafe experience, for our guests, and for others. And so, you know, I can say like, there's a strong desire internally. I really want to open more cafes. And so, but the priority has been like, we, you know, I can't remember if I said this to you on or off camera, but like really, like investing in, if we're going to continue to grow, I want to do it in a thoughtful way. That, you know, as companies grow, a lot of things often end up getting compromised or sacrificed. And so it's really important to me that we don't do that. And so trying to figure out how to grow well, how to make sure operationally that we're covered, that we're putting people in the right seats, that we're creating the right opportunities, that we're creating the right seats we should be, so that people are supported. And so, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to, improve myself in terms of organizational infrastructure and business development. And, you know, how can we set up the company for success if we choose to continue growing? I mean, especially if you look at growing retail, you're adding in one fell swoop, like 10 to 15 employees, you know, every time. And so, the importance of, having a really strong structure where people are supported, you know, can't be unspoken. And so, yeah, we're just trying to figure all those things out. And it's, you know, I haven't perfected it yet, but, tapping into a lot of other industries and things to try and learn best practices and apply them.
Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the show today, man. I've learned just a ton from, you know, the conversations and everything you're doing. So for all our listeners, be sure to check out everything that Trevor and Madcap is doing. They're an amazing coffee shop. They are some of the front runners in the United States, if not the world, in specialty coffee. And Trevor, I just want to personally thank you for everything you've done for the specialty industry. You've been a front runner and a pusher for so long. And so I'm honored to have had this conversation with you, man. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler. Thanks for inviting me, and it was a pleasure to just chat, have an opportunity to shoot the coffee.
Yeah, it was great, man. Thanks so much.